Hello, and welcome to Profiles. I'm Adam Schwartz, and today we will be getting to know TV producer and writer, novelist and playwright Bob Shanks. Bob Shanks grew up in Lebanon, Indiana, and graduated from Lebanon High School in 1950. Bob attended IU and received a Bachelor's of Science degree in radio and TV in 1954. He went on to a long career in television, during which time he received 2 Emmy Awards. As an executive, Bob Shanks for many years worked with ABC, where he created and developed Good Morning America, 2020, The Wide World of Entertainment, and various other shows. His many credits include producing The Tonight Show with Jack Parr, The Merv Griffin Show, Candid Camera, American Lifestyle, and The Great American Dream Machine for PBS. Bob Shanks is also the author of plays, teleplays, novels. He wrote The Cool Fire, How to Make It in Television, and The Primal Screen, How to Write, Sell, and Produce Movies for Television. Bob, welcome to Profiles. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Adam. I can hardly wait to see who this guy is.
What brings you to Bloomington, brings you back to Bloomington?
Well, a very nice occasion, I hope, for the Lily and also for me. I am giving all of my papers to the Lily Library, and a former head of it many years ago wanted them, and I thought I was too young at that point to dispose of them. But a wonderful man named Breon Mitchell, who is the current director of the Lily, has a long memory, I guess, and approached me, and they are acquiring my papers, and I'm very happy to have them here because it's always egotistical in a way, but also I think there are a lot of them that do give a picture of television, especially in the era in which I worked in it, and so maybe someday to some graduate student or others, it'll be helpful to know what we did and how we did it during those years.
Now, you got your undergraduate degree from IU in 1954. Mm-hmm. You were one of a very small graduating class that year. Apparently there were 4 graduates that year in 1954. And
in that field, you mean? Really?
Yeah. Well, according to your bio, yeah, there were 4 graduates in the radio TV program in 1954. It must have been a pretty unusual thing.
I guess it was a fairly new degree,
actually.
Yeah. I must confess I was surprised to be a Bachelor of Science. They put it under that. I guess I thought I would end up with a BA, but nevertheless, I guess because of the technology of television.
Television had really...
It was early going, yes, it really was. But it was wonderful here even then. I mean, I admire the plant you have now, radio and television. But then we had WFIU, and I was on it a lot, and did play-by-play of the Big Ten basketball games of the Hoosiers. We won a national title in 1953. That was fun. But I did everything. I couldn't stop volunteering. I lived at this... We were in a little Quonset hut at that time, just beyond Jordan Avenue. And it was a wonderful place. There was a man locally who had invented an early tube, I think, or some maybe a gun for the color or whatever, named Sarkis Tarzian. And he had a local television station here, one of the first to be granted a license. And pre-NFL, he used to turn over 2 or 3 hours every Sunday to IU. So we had a television studio as early as the 50s, early 50s. Huh. And I didn't know how good it was until I went on and hit New York. And sometimes we had better facilities and equipment than the networks did in those early days.
Now, you went from Indiana to New York, is that right? You started your career in New
York?
Well,
I took a couple of years off to go to the Army, yes, from 54 to 56. And that was my graduate degree, I always have said. I went to Fort Lee, Virginia, and ended up in special services. Wrote speeches for the base general and put on a weekly television program for them.
And you were an actor then, too, right?
Well, trying to be. I had the conceit that I could be, yes.
Well, right? There's a headshot of you, an 8x10 glossy of you at the Lilly Library. This is part of your papers, I noticed.
Yeah, we did plays, too. They had a little theater on the base at Fort Lee, and so poor other kids were winning whatever wars we were fighting that year, but I got to go to New York to the Film Center at Astoria 3 or 4 times to make training films, and so it really was an extension of learning my craft.
I understand when you got to New York, you wanted to talk to George S. Kaufman, the playwright.
Well, that came a little later, yes, okay. Right. That came at the Parr Show. I've scrambled around for a year and a half or so being a waiter, which turned out to be wonderful. I was a waiter in a show business saloon, actually on the site of where the ABC building was built years later. So the horse knew the way. I knew that location very well.
Around Columbus Circle?
But it was a wonderful saloon-type singer named Janice Mars, who had been a roommate of the actress Maureen Stapleton. Also in their rooming house were Marlon Brando and Wally Cox rooming together. They all went ahead to make it. Janice had not or did not. And they decided to invest in a little boite for her to sing in. So they rented the back room of a Sixth Avenue tavern at that time and fixed it up, made it very fancy and elegant. And I was the waiter, because I had been in the Army with the brother of the man who was dating Maureen Stapleton. So I became the waiter, and I had a tuxedo from IU that I still had. So it was wonderful. I met everybody. I mean, Richard Burton and Thornton Wilder and just on and on and on. Tennessee Williams was a regular, because they all loved Maureen, and she was and Marlon was one of the investors. And a superb man named Robert Whitehead, one of the most illustrious Broadway producers of all time, did all of Arthur Miller's plays, John Ennui, just endless credits in the theater. He was one of the backers, too. So it was an amazing place which paid off later when I went to the Jack Parr Show.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the shows that you worked on. You worked on the Jack Parr Show,
right.
Candid Camera, Merv Griffin. Is there any one that stands out in your mind as one that you're most proud to have worked on?
Oh, I think the most creative show, and I'm not denigrating Parr, who taught me a lot, and that really, he changed my life. That show opened the door to everything else, because there I met Merv Griffin, and just one thing led to another. But there was this point in time, before it was PBS, really, it was called NET in those days, they had devised a program, I did not create it, called The Great American Dream Machine.
Yeah, I remember watching that growing up.
Yeah, and I was able to become one of the producers. And the deal I made was, let me do an entire show so it has continuity. And so they did 20 a year, I think, and I was privileged to be able to do 2 or 3 for 1 year. And you could do everything from silly comedy blackouts to hard investigative pieces and everything in between. So that was a rare opportunity. And it was much hated by the Nixon administration, who, when he came in, really got rid of NET. That's when they set up the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and PBS and diffused the talent pool and the power of the major city stations, New York, Boston, Washington, and so forth. Everybody around the country had a vote, and the first show to go was The Great American Dream Machine. Now, going back to George S. Kaufman, when I got the Parr Show job, I thought, I've got to hit a home run here quickly, because I was hired on a temporary basis. One of the associate producers had a serious ear infection and had to be out, they thought, for 90 days. So I was really only hired for 3 months to be a talent coordinator.
Was that your first major job in
first
television?
First grown-up job, yes, okay. Really. And so I thought, I'm not staying 3 months. I want to stay longer than that. So I remembered that George, I had always admired his plays and his work, and I always thought he was wickedly funny and wonderful. And you may or may not recall, I doubt you will, there was a silly show called This Is Show Business. And it was a silly format where...
This is a TV show?
Yes, TV. Performers came on with a problem.
Huh.
In their careers or in their lives, a trumped-up problem.
Oh, it was a fake problem?
Well, no, it was their problem, but it was superficial and silly. Then this panel of wits, Kaufman was among them, were supposed to advise them what to do. And one night on the program, George S. Kaufman said, if I hear Silent Night one more time, I'm going to throw up.
Oh,
well, this created a national scandal, and he was fired instantly from the program. And this probably was 4 years before I catch up with Kaufman. And he hadn't been on television since. Those were perilous days of The Blacklist and Harry Belafonte held Petula Clark's hand, and that created a stir, a black man with a white woman holding hands. It was a strange time. I know there's a lot of nostalgia for the 50s, but there was a lot that was wrong, too. Mm-hmm. So here I am. I'm looking for a home run booking, and I thought, George S. Kaufman, he'd be wonderful with Parr, and I know Jack would like him. Because Jack liked authors. He didn't go just for stars in those days. He liked authors and talkers and storytellers, and so we had a wider latitude. You didn't just have to book Britney Spears all the time, you know, or people like that. So I thought, how do I find him? And being a naive kid from Indiana, you know, I looked him up in the phone book, and there he was, Park Avenue. I thought, that's got to be the George Kaufman. And I called, and he had a very godlike voice. Hello. And I thought, that's him. I've got him. I said, Mr. Kaufman, my name is Bob Shanks. I'm with Jack Parcher. I've been a great admirer of yours. So college and high school and always. And I proposed what I had in mind, and he said, I think I'd be very interested in that. Why don't you come up? Let's meet. And it was a different world, Adam, then. Everybody got pre-interviewed for those programs. Mm-hmm. Parr never knew the payoffs, but I would say, ask him if he ever had advice in life. And Jack trusted us to know that would lead to a story, but at the same time it kept his reaction spontaneous when he heard it on the air. Now, what often happened under the lights, the people would forget their own stories, you know? And guess who got blamed always, the booker or the talent coordinator, right? So anyway, I went up to see Kaufman, and he was wonderful. And he said, first words, he greeted me at the door. He said, I've really been thinking about this, and I want to do it. It'll prove to all my enemies that I'm still alive and maybe give some solace to my distant friends. And I was the adoring protege at his knee, and as we got older, we kind of like adoring protégés around, you know. And so we hit it off. And he wrote his appearance, the first one, almost like a one-act play. Everything was structured with payoffs and everything. And I convinced Parr. I said, Jack, you've got to have him on. He'll be wonderful. And you're going to like him. He's very likable. Because he didn't have a sterling reputation, Kaufman. He could be very acerbic. And now I will tell you, in my own experience, one of the two biggest laughs I ever heard in television. I'm not sure I should tell the Moms Mabley one, but it was on the Griffin Show. This was the Parr Show, and he said, have Jack ask me if I ever got any advice that made a difference in my life. And so Jack dutifully and called him Mr. Kaufman, and there was a kind of reverence for George at that point. And He said, well, Mr. Kaufman, who influenced you? Did you ever get any advice that you found meaningful? He said, yes, I did. I did, actually. From my grandfather. He told me to try everything in life except incest and folk dancing. Well, it was an explosive laugh. It must have lasted at least a minute. And I got to stay at the Far Show for 4 years after that booking.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, there were others, but that opened the door that, hey, maybe the kid is good. We ought to keep him.
And you said that Jack Parr influenced you, that he changed your life. How did Jack Parr influence you?
Well, first of all, personally, he had a lot of courage despite his flightiness and kind of manic, very kind man, but his nervousness made everybody else nervous around him. He was not a cruel man, though. A quick wit, he could hit you with a dagger every once in a while. But so just watching him in work and learning how jokes were constructed, I mean, that I fancy I can write jokes and have for Merv and a lot of other people since then. I didn't have that skill that I knew of until I got there. And the people who passed through the show, too. I mean, and this was if the Army was my MA, this was my PhD at the Parr Show. And because I had a college education, they put me in charge of the back of the book, we called it, which was all the authors and news journalists and those kind of people. So part of it was Jack himself, but it was also the people I met and dealt with. Then Parr, as Carson did, used to take Monday nights off, and nobody wanted to produce those who were the producers and the senior people on the staff. And so I held up my hand and said, I'll produce those nights. And that's where Merv and I first connected. I had had him as a guest on the show, and he worked very well as a guest. Jack liked him and kept bringing him back with his wife, who was kind of a fey character, had wonderful, whimsical ideas. And they had a lot of nice, cute things to talk about. But then they identified Merv as a possibility to replace Jack on Monday night. And I got to produce those. And what we would do is fill in with those shows people who Jack wouldn't have on. Among them, curiously, Barbara Streisand.
Why would he not have Barbara Streisand on?
She was an exotic at that point in time. I mean, Jack's model of a woman girl singer, we called them then, was Shirley Jones or Florence Henderson. And just that was a mindset. That's who girl singers were. And Barbara was very exotic. She looked very Middle Eastern and long fingernails, and I had found her in a club called the Bonsoir in the Village. So one night Orson Bean was the guest host, and Orson knew about her, and I said, you got to put her on, Orson. He said, oh, she's going to be the talent of her generation. So Orson, we slipped Barbara on with Orson. She got it in her mind that I was the one keeping her off the Parr Show.
That's funny, because you were the one who were promoting her to be on.
And that was part of our job, was to protect Jack, too. Uh-huh. You do it with Merv, you do it with Jack. I mean, you'd be with Jack on the street, and some performer would approach in New York, and he'd say, anytime, come on the show, anytime, you know. We'd walk him away, and he'd say, get me out of it, kid. So that was part of our job, too, to protect him and take the blame for some people never being booked. And the lists were short, I must say. He was very responsive. And he and Merv were both terrific about new talent. So anyway, I could not get Barbara booked with Jack. It was too foreign for him. And so she thought I was to blame, that I was keeping her off the Parr Show. And this is how smart and cunning she was at 17. She called me. And I said, hi, Barbara. And she said, I hear you're the nicest guy in the world. She now has my attention, right? Can I come up and see you? I'm having a problem, like the old show business format. I said, of course, yes. And I had seen her now several times at this nightclub because I thought she was an enormous talent. So she came into the office and she had this story. Only my being from Indiana and naive could she have gotten away with this, I think. You know, she said, you know, I'm from the Midwest too. I'm from Cleveland. And my mother's back there dying of cancer. And do you think I have a career in show business? I said, oh, absolutely, Barbara, absolutely. Don't give it up, because she was under pressure to go home with an old boyfriend and to take care of her mother. I said, absolutely, keep going, keep going. Then is when I really leaned on the guest host to get her on. And so Orson, fortunately, had known her and said, absolutely, bring her on. She'd be terrific. And she was, and all of that. Now, fade to black, come up many years later. I'm the VP in charge of Barbara Walters at ABC to start her specials. And Barbara said, I have a wonderful idea for the first show specials. She said, I've got Jimmy Carter, who had just been elected but not yet inaugurated, and Henry Kissinger. And I said, well, Barbara, if you do that show, there will be no second Barbara Walters special. She said, what do you mean? I said, it's wonderful to have Carter, but you can't do the whole hour with Carter and Kissinger. You
can't have two politicians.
Exactly.
On show, yeah.
And she said, well, whom should I have on? And I don't know. I looked down, saw an ad for A Star Is Born, and I said, Barbara Streisand. She's got a new movie, and she's kinky and interesting, and she's got a new boyfriend, this hairdresser, John Peters. And Barbara got on the phone immediately, which she did. I admire her so much. She mostly books her own talent, makes the calls, types up the notes. Anyway, so I did a pre-session at Streisand's house to survey it, to where we would set up the cameras and everything. She cooked. It was a very Hamisher kind of evening. You know, it was wonderful. And as we're leaving, she called me back and said, Bob, it was Detroit. And slammed the door, not Cleveland. So she had read that I had done this in Cool Fire, I guess. And I'm not sure I had the narrative connections there tight enough.
You're listening to Profiles. My guest tonight is TV producer and writer, novelist and playwright Bob Shanks. Let's take a break. Listen to some music that you've chosen. Why did you choose this piece? Tell us a little bit about this piece, Steve McQueen.
Because my son co-wrote it. I'm out there cheerleading for my son now. His name is John Shanks, and he won a Grammy this February for Best Producer of the Year. And he is very hot and very active. This coming year, he'll be producing albums for Bon Jovi, Santana, and Melissa Etheridge, and another one for Sheryl Crow. Last year, he did the teeny bopper girls, I call them, Ashley Simpson, Hillary Duff, so on and so forth, plus Sheryl Crow and others, and he and Sheryl wrote this song together.
This is Steve McQueen, performed by Sheryl Crow. Music chosen by my guest on Profiles tonight, Bob Shanks.
Well, I went to bed in Memphis and I woke up in Hollywood. I got a quarter in my pocket and I'd call you if I could. But I don't know why I gotta lie. I wanna rock and roll this party. I still wanna have some fun. I wanna leave you feeling breathless, show you how the West was won. But I gotta.
Well, now we're with Merv.
Yeah,
right?
I wanted to ask you, this was in the 60s, the Merv Griffin
right.
show. It was a big show. How many years, it must have been 6 years that show was on.
Merv was I remember these dates. January 29th, 1962
wow.
was his first replacement show on yeah. The Tonight Show. And he had a wonderful idea. Merv had the idea. There was a comedian named Al Kelly who did double talk and reverse talk.
Right.
He would start coherently, and then he would go into double talk, right. and it sounded as though something was wrong with you.
Right.
And so Merv brought him on as his agent. He said, a lot of you don't know who I am, and I thought I'd bring my agent on because he does a good job telling people who I am. So Al Kelly comes out, and he begins, oh, Merv Griffin is a wonderful talent. You're going to love him. And then he goes into this double. It was wonderful. It was a great way to open the show. Mm-hmm. And kind of self-effacing for Merv. And it was charming. It was funny. Now, I'm backstage, herding the guests and whatever. Kelly comes off. I thank him. Merv comes off. I said, where are you going? He said, I can't do this. I cannot do this show. I said, Merv, are you kidding? You just had a brilliant opening segment. Our singer was a new singer we introduced called Aretha Franklin, the first time she had been on television. I said, I grabbed him physically and pushed him back onto the stage. He just hit one of those panic moments.
Now, this was when the show was still being taped.
We were in a commercial break, yes.
So it's like sort of stage fright.
Live on tape. It was live. We used to do it at 7:30 in the evening, and 8:30 to 10, and then they'd play it back at 11:30.
And he just had some kind of attack of stage fright?
Exactly, exactly. And he said, I can't deal with 10 million people out there watching me. I said, okay, here's what we'll do. It's not 10 million. It's one person. It's the camera eye. You know what I'm going to do? Could you do it just for me, the show? He said, yeah, I could do that. And we were two guys talking. I said, I'm going to stand by the number one camera and play the show to me. Mm-hmm. Just talk to me. So he went back into the chair, settled down, and it was a wonderful evening. We had he really scored big that night. And it led to my having to sit in the front row for 6 years.
Really?
Now, he was long over the need for me there, but he kind of liked to have me there. Anyway, that's how that began. He tells it, too, in his book, so I'm not talking out of school. But,
now, that was not the first time that you've saved the day. I remember in reading in one of your books about an instance where you were shooting a TV show. I think it was in New York on the street, and it was in the middle of a thunderstorm.
Oh, it was the worst month in New York in its history, I think, for rain. And we were doing a special, everything on location. Now, some of it we got lucky. We did a number with Joel Grey, who was then in George M.
So this was in the 70s or something?
Late 60s. It must have been 68, I think. And we had Dionne Warwick singing two of her biggest hits in front of the Pulitzer Fountain, in front of the Plaza Hotel, and it was beautiful. She was beautiful. It was raining a bit, so we had her in a yellow slicker. And then the skies just opened. We could not get a take. And now it's midnight. She has to be in Las Vegas overnight to open the next night at a club there. Then we got a little break in the weather, and I said to the director, okay, we've got to get this. We've got to get this, because we had all the wide shots and everything, but not enough for me to patch a song together. So I'm in the control booth truck, which is only about 50 feet from where Dionne was, and it starts again in the middle of the take. And I don't know where it came from. I said to the director, zoom it up her nose, get as close as you can. Oh, she had an umbrella, and the wind was starting to take the umbrella. And she did not stop. She is so disciplined that if she knew we didn't yell cut, that she was still performing.
And at this point, the umbrella had reversed itself. Right?
It was inside out.
Yeah. You can't use it. It would look terrible.
Kirk, who was the director, Kirk Alexander, I said, go as tight as you can on her face, and she had a beautiful face anyway. I'm going out there. and I'm going to save the umbrella, and we're going to save this shot somehow. It's our last chance, because now we're going into overtime with union people, and it would have cost a fortune to keep going, and it didn't get better later. It poured all night. So I did. I ran out, grabbed the umbrella. She never missed a beat. I came up approaching her within camera, within her vision, so she knew I was coming up there, and we knew each other. She knew I was the producer and wasn't some guy assaulting her out of Central Park. You know? So then I moved around behind her, stabilized the umbrella, brought it back.
And all the time, the camera does not see this because it's on a very tight close-up.
Really, with this little yellow slicker hood around her face.
And she's still singing throughout this whole thing.
And she's still singing. So I stabilized it. We got a break from the heavens. The wind died down. The rain moderated. It was rather gorgeous that there was some rain, actually, with the lighting. I crawled out, went back to the booth, soaking wet, you know, and we got the shot. And it was beautiful.
That's great.
That's a producer's job. You have to do a lot of nimble thinking on your feet to save situations.
Well, especially if you really care about the product. That's something that comes through in your books, is that you care about how the final product looks, and you have a commitment to quality.
And some of that I credit Indiana for. You learned disciplines and the honor of work, and to give an honest day's work for an honest dollar, right? And I kept some of that innocence and naivete, and yes, I did. I took very seriously any show that I did.
My guest is Bob Shanks on this edition of Profiles. Now, Bob, you've written two books about television. One is about making movies, especially for television, mm-hmm. and the other is about making it in the TV industry. You've written and produced several TV movies, and I noticed that two of them are on the same theme, the idea of dropping out of society. One of them was called Dropout Father, and it starred right. Dick Van Dyke as a father who quits his job and quits his responsibilities. And I'm curious, how did you come to write that script? And
a good friend of mine said, how did you get these subversive movies on television? But they were comedies, which was very rare in the movie form. You seldom
really?
See.
Really? Now, this was what, in the 60s?
This was Dropout Father was the first one, 82.
Okay.
And I'll tell you how the business works. Anne and I submitted 40 other ideas for movies. And
40?
After the success of Dropout Father, it was a huge success. Nobody gets ratings like these today.
Now, was this on CBS, I'm guessing?
CBS, uh-huh. right. And you got to take advantage of the happy accidents, too, Adam. A woman at NBC, we took this idea to first, named Dionne Barclay, whom I had known in New York. She married one of my staff on the Griffin Show. So now she's head of movies at NBC, right? So the accident of our having known each other. In fact, we threw their engagement party at our apartment in New York. Anyway, we took it to Dionne. She had to pass. She picked it up. I got paid by NBC for the script. They had no management, and they cut back the movies, and they certainly didn't want to do comedy movies. That was the beginning of the era, torn from the headlines. So she said, I love this script, Bob, but I can't do it. They're not going to let me do it. So I read that Steve Mills was now head of movies at CBS, who had been a colleague at ABC. He had been in charge of West Coast programming or something for ABC at that point. So Steve got what's called a free read in the business. I had the script. And you're allowed to have a script in turnaround. If a network passes on it, if you sell it within a short time, the buying network has to pay the other network back the money. Fortunately, that time limit had run out, so I got paid twice for this script, once by NBC, and Steve liked it. He said, it's soft. It's a soft movie. which means it didn't have a high concept gimmick or sex and violence. You know? And they call those soft movies. I said, but it's funny, Steve. And he said, yes, it really is. You've written a very funny script. And he said, all right, let me talk to the management. And they have to go through layers too. Anyway, we arrive at a December decision time on the movie. And he made it Ann and my burden to find a star. And I had pitched in Dick Van Dyke, and they thought he was old at CBS at that point.
He must have been in his
82, this was.
In his 50s, yeah, I'm guessing.
Late 50s, early 60s. But lives got chewed up. You know? Fortunately, 2 weeks before, he was reduced to emceeing some silly pageant or Miss Atlantic City or something. But he looked great. He looked great. I got that tape, and I must say the people that CBS wanted me to go after, I won't name, but they would have been dead wrong for the part. Just, they were wrong. They were big names, hot. They were on the hot list, but they would have been wrong for the film. But dutifully, I went through the steps, still being a pest about Dick Van Dyke. And I brought this tape in to Steve, who had not seen the show. He said, my Lord, he looks wonderful. He looks really young. I said, yeah, maybe we can salt and pepper his hair. He had let it go all white. Then I ran into a problem with Dirk that he didn't want to do that. He liked it all white. This is what you run into. You know? But anyway, I said, we can only get Dick for a three-week window in January. And Steve said, my Lord, it's middle December. You'll never get the movie made. I said, yes, we were. And Ann stood up. She was my wife. She was in the meeting, too. And she said, Steve, that movie will be made if you okay it today. We will get it made on time, under budget. And he said, I don't believe it. I don't believe it can happen. She said, call in your production manager right now, and we'll talk it through. What's the budget? What problems he sees? He loved the script, by the way. He wanted to make the movie. So Ann knew she had an ally in him, and he said, absolutely they can do it, but you've got to decide today, Steve. So he did, and we got Dick, and then quickly had a wonderful cast. We got Marietta Hartley to play Dick's wife. I had to rewrite the first act a little to bring her into it more. And then with wonderful supporting characters. It went through the roof. It had the highest rating of any CBS movie in about 5 years before and two or three years after. Now, Ann and I think we're hot stuff, right? They'll give us a three-picture deal. And Steve was a very laconic guy from Kansas, and we kind of share a Midwest bond. He said, it doesn't work that way here. So come back with other ideas. So Ann and I had a list of 30 pictures I wanted to make. And you reported to Steve's subordinates, so VPs, but under, he was the VP of VPs. They passed on all of them, and there were some very good ideas.
All 40 of them?
Yeah, there were very good ideas in there. Then they bought an unpublished novel that had a good hook, we call it, or a good device, where her husband gets fired, and he somehow maneuvers to get his wife hired to do his old job, and he talks her through it on the phone, and she gets great at it, and blah, blah, blah. That one's called He's Fired, She's Hired. So I did that in the meantime, but we said, and it did well. It won its time period. It didn't go through the roof like Dropout Father. And I finally then asked for a meeting with Steve. I said, look, I know the deal. You have to give 4 a year to Paramount. You have to give 5 to Universal. You have to give 3 pictures to your hot series stars. But you can't put us out of business, independence. And these are good ideas, Steve. And he looked over the list. He said, yes, they are, but why don't you do Dropout Mother? I said, oh, come on. Well, that's the pattern in Hollywood. If you have a success with one, they want the
it's
flip
safe.
Side.
It's safe.
It's a franchise, they call it. So we did, and it did all right, too. But that's why there are two of them.
Well, what advice would you have for, say, a young person who wants to, well, we can take your pick, either wants to make it in the TV industry or who wants to, like you, write and produce TV movies?
Scott Fitzgerald said 60 years ago that writers are the women of Hollywood, because women had a very low status in the 30s and 40s. It's improved somewhat, but I'm afraid it's still basically true. It's an old boys' club still, and programming a lot of it. So that's one thing you have to overcome. Writers are not taken very seriously. The writers have limited power.
Yeah, you in one of your books you had a chart of the of movie directors, if I recall, novelists, and screenwriters, just to compare who do you recognize from that group.
Right.
And the novelists and the film directors were all were household names.
Sure.
But the screenwriters, I didn't know any of them. Uh-huh. And yet the screenwriter is the one who comes up with the original idea.
Oh,
without
absolutely.
The screenwriter, there wouldn't
absolutely.
Be a movie. Is that still a case that our screenwriters still undervalued in Hollywood?
They are. They are.
Why is that? Are they just not so visible as the director is always visible and he's glamorous?
When the page is blank, there's one writer, right?
Mm-hmm.
The minute the page is filled, everybody's a writer. And it's a business. It's a business. It's run by more and more than even in my time. It's run now by MBAs and accountants and lawyers. It's strictly a business. Writers are no longer called writers. They're called content providers. Nice accounting term, mm-hmm. isn't it?
What are some of the changes you've observed over the years since starting in TV in the 50s from now? Mm-hmm. You must have seen.
Well, I think
changes.
Early on there was more respect for the creative side. Mm-hmm. Now we're hired hands for the corporations. You know? That's the biggest change in power. And the creators had power. Aaron Spelling, Norman Lear, those people had justifiable power because they were creative producers. They weren't business people. And I think it's shifted more and more to the business side. As Irving Thalberg said way back at MGM about writers, they're a necessary evil, he called them. Now, I was lucky. I knew right away my power as a writer would be enhanced by producing the movies.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to get to that. So that's why you started producing.
Right, and I was established as a producer and had been a VP at ABC in charge of other producers and people. So I really had the credentials as a producer. I was the novice as a writer. But I thought, if I produce this movie, I can protect my own script. And that's exactly what happened, right? So it's very tough, Adam, just to be the writer.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're almost better off writing screenplays. There's somehow more respect still for the writer. And, of course, you got to be 14 and have the hottest new concept and everything. But just, I think, in general, there's more of an opening for writers to do a screenplay than there is a... First of all, they've cut back the number of movies of the week, we call them, but they don't do them every week now.
You mentioned in one of your books how TV shapes society.
Yes.
This was back in the 80s, but you had mentioned how in one particular week more Americans would have heard of a certain Olympic athlete, say, who had won a medal, whereas in that same week two scientists had discovered a cure for malaria.
For malaria.
Yeah. And you expressed a certain ambivalence about working in TV. And I'm curious to know, do you still feel that ambivalence or have you resolved it at all?
Oh, I do. I think it's always a tension between the creative types and the business types. And look, it is a popular medium. It has to make money. I was never naive about that, and I never resisted that trying to get a rating and trying to make money for the people who were paying me money. And I'm not naive about that. But there were nuanced differences, I think, when there were only three networks. They knew it was a monopoly. They knew it was a money machine. And the Paley, Sarnoff, Leonard Goldenson felt a social contract with the society. First of all, the rules were much tougher. The Broadcast Act of 1934 imposed much stricter rules than the Broadcast Act of 96, which was written by the broadcasters and was a big giveaway, I think, that we still pay a societal price for. But anyway, when it was a monopoly, semi-monopoly, they felt a great sense of social responsibility. And they answered every letter that came in from the public. We gave... I literally had the controller at ABC come to me at one point and said, we've got so much money, we've got to get rid of some of it. Can you come up with an idea? So I said, let's establish a writer's prize and we'll guarantee that it'll get on air, a two-hour movie form. But we'll pay him, too. He'll get paid and a guarantee. So we made an association with the Eugene O'Neill Center in Connecticut that had an ongoing program in the summers of new playwrights. So I thought that would be a seedbed to find some fairly decent scripts. And out of that, we found Christopher Durang, who went on to be a playwright whom we could not produce on television. He was so wild, but a wonderful talent. And that worked out. And there was just more of a sense of social responsibility then. Then when cable came along and the diffusion of power and talent, although it ends up being the same five or six companies that are now owning not only the network, but most of the cable channels too. So,
Bob, we only have about a minute left. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on a book of history, don't ask me why, but it's a period in American history that interests me, and I won't even tell you what it's about, because if I can't go the distance, it'll be too embarrassing, but I'm a third of the way finished with that. And it's a period that I see as the beginning of American empire, and maybe how we got to where we are today, although I never talk about today. So that's one thing. I've got two or three plays that I want to write that I can't stop looking at the flowers and the deer. And
now you live in
I live in a kind of rural area now.
Massachusetts.
Yes, in the Berkshires in Massachusetts. But I'm busy.
Great. My guest tonight on Profiles has been TV producer, writer, novelist, and playwright Bob Shanks. And Bob, let's go out on another piece that you've chosen, the Jupiter Symphony by Mozart. What made you choose the Jupiter Symphony?
I was working on a play about a scientist, and I had heard it here at IU and over the years, but I had never really focused on it, and did for this play and re-fell in love with it.
My guest on this edition of Profiles has been Bob Shanks. For Profiles, I'm Adam Schwartz. Thanks for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in April of 2005. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blacklin, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.